and welcome to Counsel for the State. I'm Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin. Counsel for the State is a podcast produced by my office. Our goal in each episode is to share information with Idaho residents, journalists, and anyone with an interest in state government. Our aim is to increase transparency, further understanding of the office's role in government, and discuss timely legal topics. I hope you enjoy this installment and consider exploring past episodes as well. With that, here is the Office of the Attorney General, Public Information Officer, and Counsel for the State host, Scott Graff.
Welcome to Counsel for the State. In our most recent episode of the podcast, we previewed last month's special session of the Idaho Legislature. Today, we shift our focus to another branch of state government, the judicial branch. Specifically, we'll spend the duration of today's episode discussing the Idaho Supreme Court. Our special guest for today's podcast is Justice Robin Brody. Justice Brody is in her first term as a member of the Idaho Supreme Court. She won her current term in office in November of 2016. Prior to her campaign, she practiced law for nearly two decades in the state's Magic Valley, working out of offices in Twin Falls and then her own practice in Rupert. She is a graduate of the University of Denver, where she earned her law degree, along with a master's in international business. Justice, it is an honor to have you with us. Thank you very much for being on Counsel for the State.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
Also here for today's discussion is Brian Kane, the Office of the Attorney General's Assistant Chief Deputy. In that role, Brian has argued cases in front of the state Supreme Court, and perhaps his most important role in all, Brian is also co-host of this podcast, Counsel for the State. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
So, Justice Brody, I mentioned a few of your facts and your background, your legal work being among them. But if you wouldn't mind taking an opportunity here as we start the podcast to share a little bit more about who you are and where you come from for Brian and I and for our audience as well. We would appreciate that.
Well, sure. Well, Scott, I'm a wife. I'm a mom. I've got two boys that are right now, let's see, they're 13 and 15. We have a little bit of a crazy life in that my husband is actually a district judge in Minidoka County. And so the kids and I are here in Boise full time, where the boys go to school, and we spend weekends either in Rupert or my husband comes up here. So we love Idaho and love being a part of both communities.
And prior to your decision to seek a seat on the court, what type of law were you practicing?
So I had really a pretty varied practice. I grew up in a law firm called Hepworth. It was actually Hepworth, Lathames, and Hahnhorst when I went to work there back in, it must have been 97, and spent 13 years with that firm, really doing a ton of litigation, but also a fair number of transactions, or transactional work, working with farmers, doctors, businesses, the Twin Falls Clinic and Hospital. Some folks may remember that entity. But really a broad general practice, and then branched out on my own and started my own practice in Rupert in 2010.
And then the lead up to the run for office in 2016, what made you decide that this was something that, that you wanted to do, to be a state Supreme Court justice?
Well, you know, it's people ask me about that, and it's, you know, did you think about, you know, ever wanting that job? And it was always something that was kind of an asterisk in the back of my mind, in the sense that arguing cases before the Idaho Supreme Court was always the place that I probably felt the most comfortable, the place where I felt like it played to all of my strengths and to my passions, talking about the law and having amazing discussions with, you know, talented judges and justices. And I'm sure Brian can attest to that. For me, there was nothing better than arguing cases in front of the Idaho Supreme Court. So for me, it was, you know, really that opportunity to really make a difference in terms of how the system functions overall for people throughout the state, not just for my individual clients.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you remember how many times you argued in front of the state Supreme Court before you joined the court?
You know, there was a time when I could have answered that question definitively. I think it's either 8 or 9. I can't remember for sure.
Okay, so you were very familiar with it.
Absolutely, yes. And I remember the arguments very, very well. You don't forget them as a lawyer, that's for sure.
That ended up being a fairly crowded race. If memory serves, it ended up in a runoff. I'm curious, was that your first campaign for, I don't know if I would call that public office or not, but was it your first campaign?
Well, let me put it this way. It was the first campaign as a candidate. I had worked on plenty of political campaigns before then. Actually, before my husband joined the judiciary, we were active in Magic Valley politics. But always as a worker bee, you know, I built a lot of floats for parades and that kind of thing, but never as a candidate. And so it was really a terrific experience. I couldn't have asked for anything better. That campaign took me to places throughout Idaho that I know I would never have otherwise made my way to them.
Well, and I think that it really shows, you know, kind of what a student of campaigning you were, because, you know, I've watched a lot of campaigns over the years, including ones for justice. And I think you ran maybe one of the most impressive campaigns that I've had the opportunity to witness. And I guess in that regard, have you done any, do you have any advice for folks that are maybe thinking about running? I mean, I recognize that you're somewhat of, you're a trailblazer, right? You're the third woman justice on the Idaho Supreme Court. And so I feel like you're a trailblazer, you're a role model. Any advice for folks?
Well, those are really kind words. I don't really see myself that way, but I'll tell you what, I think if you've got a passion for people, and a passion, to get to know them, I think campaigning is a magnificent way to do that. I had so many people who were willing to help along the way. And that's something that I tell, I get the chance in this job to talk to a lot of young people, both, you know, kids from about the fifth grade on up through adulthood. And I tell them one of the most important things that you can do in life is to let people know what's in your heart, what you want to do. And I'll tell you what, so many people, when they know those things, are willing to help in any way that they can. So I would tell people, dive in. You know, if you've got a passion to serve and you enjoy people, I think it's taking on a campaign is a great way to do that.
Justice, you perhaps noted my hesitation to even call it a public office, because it's so different than, for instance, someone who runs for state lawmaker, or even for Brian and I's boss, Attorney General Wasden. I'm curious to know, having sat in the catbird seat on other types of political campaigns versus one for the state Supreme Court, how do they differ?
Well, so think about the word politics. The word politics means of the people. And I think in that sense, even a Supreme Court justice race is about the people. It's of the people. In terms of the campaign itself, I mean, I think justices and judges, not just justices, judges throughout this state have ethical canons that really restrict our ability to talk about how we might decide particular issues that come before us. We can't do that. And in that way, I think it's different than what people might think of in terms of a political race. I mean, I'm not going to be out there making campaign promises or anything like that about I'm going to make this decision, that decision, the other decision. I think really what the campaign becomes about is teaching people what the judiciary really does, in Idaho specifically. What our Constitution requires us to do. And we can talk about our judicial philosophies, the way that we approach legal questions, the way that we approach, issues. We can talk about our views from that perspective. So I think in that way it's different. But, I looked at it. I welcomed every opportunity I got to talk to people about what the judiciary does.
What is a typical campaign stop for a Supreme Court justice, or a prospective, in this case, Supreme Court justice, look like?
Oh my gosh. Well, it varied in so many different ways. I mean, it may be running the parade route in Idaho Falls during the 4th of July, which, let me tell you, if you've never been to the 4th of July parade in Idaho Falls, put it on your bucket list. It's really something that is tremendous. To having coffee with a group of Republicans up in Coeur d'Alene at the IHOP at 7 o'clock in the morning, when they meet, you know, once a week or once a month to talk about political issues. Or it may be going to the Eastern Idaho State Fair and hanging out and eating tiger ears and watching the demolition derby. See, I even had a demolition derby car.
That sounds like that's a great experience. So now that you've been through the process of running successfully for Supreme Court justice, you know, one of the debates that Idaho goes through fairly routinely is whether Supreme Court justices should be appointed or elected. And I'm wondering if, having been through the process and now sat on the bench for a few years, if you have a point of view on that.
Well, Brian, I come at this from, in my heart, I'm always a practitioner. You know, I practiced law for years in the trenches, and I'll tell you what, I'm a huge believer in our jury system, and I believe more than 9 times out of 10, our juries get things just right. And so for me, the giving the people of Idaho the right to choose their justices, I'd vote for that every day of the week. Having said that, I mean, I know that not everybody shares my view, but and some people think that it really needs to be an appointed position so that people, you know, so that it's not subject to political leanings and that kind of thing. I frankly think either system, whether it be pure appointment or judicial elections, can be subject to the same political winds. And like I said, at the end of the day, for me, I'll take my chances with the people of the state.
Sure. I think that I can certainly understand that. And I think that, you know, there are quite a few folks that would agree with that perspective. Do you think that that having the position elected as opposed to appointed creates a wider net for potential Supreme Court justices?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I guess I haven't really thought about it from that perspective. You know, I'd like to believe that even at the end of the day, people can smell the candidate who is highly qualified and who belongs in the position, no matter what. So, I mean, in that regard, I think the people are going to choose widely or wisely rather than just based on political whim. So I don't know. I mean, it's, I think both processes really try to get at the best candidate for the job.
There are 5 justices on the state Supreme Court, each being elected to a 6-year term. If my math is correct, Justice Brody, you would be up for re-election in the fall of 2022. We've now got inside the 2-year window after the primaries back in May. Do you want to break any news here on counsel for the state in regards to your future with the court?
So that's a couple years from now, but I can tell you, all things being equal, and if the creek don't rise, you know, I intend to put my hat in the ring again. It'll actually be in the spring of 2022, the way that judicial races work. The only time that we get into the fall elections is in a case like mine, where we had a runoff. Judicial elections, you have to actually be elected by a true majority, which is 50% plus one vote. And so you mentioned that crowded race. There were 4 of us who were on the ballot in the spring of 16. And so it just meant in the primary, I just couldn't get the 50% vote. You know, divvying it up 4 ways. So the top 2 vote getters, I was number 1, and then a sitting senator was number 2, and so he and I had a face off in November. So spring of 2022, I'll need people's help.
And just so you know, Scott, historically that runoff is a rarity in Idaho in the Supreme Court justice races. Usually, that race is decided within the May primary. And so that makes Justice Brody even more interesting because she ran for the office essentially twice because she had to get through that crowded field and then through the runoff. And probably that experience also caused her to see just about every nook and cranny of this great state.
Yeah. And Justice, you mentioned when you were campaigning, you found yourself presented with an opportunity to educate Idahoans about the state Supreme Court, about what it is constitutionally, what its role is mandated to be in our state level of government here. There is so much ink that gets spilled about the U.S. Supreme Court. It'll be another focal point this fall as the presidential election moves along, of course. It was 4 years ago. It's been in the news many, many times between 2016 and now. But it sort of seems to, when there's a discussion about a Supreme Court, that federal level court kind of takes all the air out of the discussion. And I don't feel like state Supreme Courts get nearly the attention for as within each state is, you know, their importance really equates to. I'm curious, when you encountered those Idahoans and you got to talk about what it is that the court does in our state, did you find there to be some gaps in sort of the understanding of what it is our court does in the state of Idaho?
Well, when I told my mom I was going to run for office for the Idaho Supreme Court, she looked at me and said, we have one of those. And so I said, we do, and explained that not only do we have one, but all 50 states have one. And so my education process began actually just right at home. You know, the Idaho Supreme Court is so true. I mean, people think automatically when they think of Supreme Court justice, they think of Washington, D.C. When you're talking to people in Idaho, their hair gets a little, I get a little excited about that because they can probably think of some decisions they don't like coming out of Washington, D.C. And so a lot of my process, especially during the campaign, was to step back and say, wait a minute, let's talk about the Idaho Supreme Court. And, you know, I explained that one of the very big roles, we've really got three jobs. One is the Idaho Constitution provides that Idaho have an integrated and unified court system from the top of the state to the bottom. And the Idaho Supreme Court is really in charge of the management of that system. That's the first job, the management of the system. Number two, of course, the cases that come before us. And oh my gosh, we have very interesting appeals, but many of them not necessarily the big constitutional questions that people debate about and where all the ink gets spilled. Those cases, they sometimes find their way to the Idaho Supreme Court, but rarely. We're more about the nuts and bolts of what of people's lives, property disputes, divorces, custody disputes, criminal cases, and don't get me wrong, incredibly important, but just a little bit different focus than the U.S. Supreme Court. And then the third job that we've got is really just the kind of thing that I'm doing right now, which is public outreach, explaining how the third branch really operates. And there's a real civic component to my job. People ask me what the thing is that I enjoy the most. And I love talking to the fifth graders that come every spring during field trip season and take a tour of the court. And, you know, I get to talk to them about what we do.
And I think of those three roles, obviously, deciding the high-profile cases that folks who pay attention to Idaho politics follow. Everybody knows about it. You know, that it's a public proceeding. You can tune in and watch the proceedings online. And sometimes a lot of people do with the high-profile cases, and then some cases are argued and decided well outside the public eye. But typically, when there is a case that a lot of people are paying attention to, folks tune in, they see those proceedings, those arguments made, and then the court, that adjourns, and the process then begins behind the scenes to come up with the opinion. And I would love to spend some time today focusing on what that process looks like behind the scenes. And I recognize there may be some things that you can't talk about, but once that, you know, the court is gaveled, the arguments are over, and then it is up to you and your four other benchmates to issue an opinion at some point in the future. What does that first step in the process look like?
All right. Well, so let me take it back one step further, and it's actually before the case gets heard, before we have an oral argument. So basically, we hear, the Supreme Court hears about 15 cases a month. All right. We usually schedule 5 days worth of hearings, three hearings a day. And you can find the information on our website. You can find the links. Even during this pandemic, you can watch us on Zoom. You can watch us actually conduct the oral arguments. But before those oral arguments actually take place, usually about 3 or 4 months in advance of those oral arguments, once the case is ready to be heard, so that is the parties have submitted their briefs and everything is ready to go, our law clerks go down. And by the way, this is a process that the court has used, as far as I know, forever. Our law clerks, we have the five of us have two law clerks. They are extremely capable young lawyers, very bright. They go down to our clerk's office. The clerk of the court is the person who maintains all of the cases and the documents and all that kind of thing. They go down and there's this little oak box that has 15 tiles in it, just like Scrabble tiles, 1 to 15, and we have a list of cases, 1 to 15. And they go around and they in a circle and draw the tiles so that each justice then knows what three cases they are going to be responsible for in terms of getting them ready for hearing. So once those cases are drawn, and by the way, there's a whole kind of tradition around that. There's a little oak box, and we've got a replica that we still use to this day. The original oak box with the tile is down in a display case in the front foyer of our court. So people can see it. It's pretty cool. And there's always an order. We always speak in order. We do everything in order. It's usually the newest member of the court goes first in everything, and then we just keep that order going. So once the cases have been drawn, then the justice and their law clerks will prepare, the law clerks in particular, will prepare what's called a pre-hearing memorandum. This is an internal document that goes to the justices. This is the clerk's work, the clerk's summary of all the arguments and the recommendations of the clerk in terms of how the clerk thinks that the arguments should play out. That's the pre-hearing memorandum. We do not talk about cases before they go to hearing. We don't discuss them with each other. So the first time when we're there in the courtroom, we are hearing each other for the first time ask questions and say things in court about the case. We've never heard it before, or never talked about it before. Once we get off the bench, we usually hold a short conference immediately following the oral argument. And we will, I call this, or I liken it to kind of feeling which way the wind is blowing. Everybody will provide kind of their take on the case, where things should go. And really, it's up to the assigned justice after that process to craft an opinion that the justice thinks is the right one. And that's where the devil is always in the details. So once that initial conference has taken place, I come back, I talk with my clerks, talk about where I want things to go, and work with the clerk to get a what we call a proposed semi-final opinion. And then we circulate that document to the court as a whole, so all five of us get it. And really, then you go through the process of looking at that opinion line by line, word by word, providing feedback, you know, justices at that point in time can vote. They can, maybe we want to conference it and talk about it more. More often than not, we conference the case again. Every month we hold what's called oral conference, which is kind of where we manage our pipeline of cases, where we get together and talk about all the cases that are in process. And that's where lots of details get ironed out. And at that point in time, you know, if it looks like at some point that maybe the justice's view of the case is not going to prevail, then maybe the case will be reassigned to another justice who's in the majority opinion, and in which case a new justice will take over the opinion, and then the process of kind of reconfiguring the proposed semifinal takes place. So there's a lot of wrinkles. Chief Justice Burdick always tells the story of one of our decisions taking 19 drafts to finally get an opinion. I haven't worked on one that's taken that many drafts, but boy, they can sometimes take a lot of work.
So with that process, you described it as having lots of wrinkles. I would assume that it's even more wrinkly now that you're somewhat remote.
Yeah, you know, it's this is a shame. It's a process that, you know, is dynamic.
Right.
And working with people, I think a lot of times you just need to be in the same room. And so in that regard, I don't like it at all. Having said that, I mean, the group now has been together long enough that we have, I think, a pretty good feel for one another in terms of, and we feel comfortable being ourselves and sharing our views and all that kind of thing, because, you know, it takes some trust to share those views and also for the other person to feel comfortable accepting what might feel like criticism, you know, of something that's been written. And so we're able to work through it. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I walk in this building and I'm just like, you know, it's so interesting because the building feels hollow without the people inside it.
Right.
And that's really, really missing. And you know, there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that will replace that human interaction.
Sure. Has that then changed your relationship with your clerks, for example?
Well, yes. I mean, it's, I don't get to know them as well, right? So, I mean, I have two brand new law clerks. Now, one of them I've worked with before, and he was actually my student, all right? Student at Concordia University. He was in my trial advocacy class. And so I feel like I've gotten to know him, and I know him very well. But I have another brand new clerk who I don't have that relationship with yet. And he and I will have to work to develop it over time, you know, and I think it just takes more effort,
right,
to really cultivate that friendship.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that one of the things that I've noticed that you lose within this kind of remote environment, and it sounds like this may impact the court just as greatly, is the more casual exchanges that can sometimes really help when you're working through problem solving and whatnot. And it sounds like that's part of what you're kind of lamenting being gone, is that the ability to just stop by and have a very brief conversation, or to just touch base on an issue.
Yeah. And just laugh. I mean, you know, look, some of the work we do, and it can feel pretty heavy. I mean, we're dealing with incredibly important issues, life and death, frankly. And sometimes just the ability to talk about those things in person, sometimes just the ability to laugh, find the humor in those places where we can find it. I mean, there's nothing quite like reading a trial transcript, Brian, you know that.
Oh, yeah.
All the things that go on in the courtroom are awesome. And you sometimes you just can't make it up.
Right.
And so you miss those things.
Justice, some decisions need to be made quickly. There was one earlier this year that involved two parts of state government that ended up on opposite sides of an argument made in front of the court, and that decision came from you folks fairly quickly. At what point in the process do you decide a timeline for a case? Because that, you know, that's an instance where the decision was needed very quickly, you delivered a decision quickly, but there are others where there isn't necessarily as pressing of a timeline or a deadline, and sometimes it can be months and months and months between the ending of oral arguments and when a decision is ultimately delivered.
Yeah, I think, as I recall, the last time we looked at the numbers, it takes on average about 16 months from the time a case actually starts its way up to the Idaho Supreme Court to the time it gets decided. And actually, that in appellate land, that is pretty dang quick. And the court has worked really hard to get those decisions out. Having said that, I'd like to think that the five of us have a very pragmatic view of the world. People are like, well, do you really know what's going on out there? Well, I'd like to think we do. And we certainly know when people are waiting on us for decisions, and we take that responsibility very seriously, and I think all of us share the view that we have a responsibility to respond as quickly as we possibly can without shortcutting the process that we have to work through to get it done. Now, you got to understand, we make decisions with a group of five of us, and you know how hard it is to get five people to agree on pizza, let alone agree on the content of a 30-page written opinion.
Yeah. Well, and I also would imagine that timelines, you know, that are spread out over 16 months, that presents some inefficiencies in that you have to refamiliarize yourself with arguments and with a particular case. If you're dealing with, you know, many, many different cases, and then, you know, it seems like over 16 months, it could be weeks and perhaps, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe not, perhaps months in between revisiting a court case and then letting it sit idle and then revisiting again. Is there an issue with sort of getting familiar with the specifics again when there are long lapses between drafts, say, of an opinion?
Well, let me explain the time frame a little bit. Once the case, some of the time that takes, or some of the some of the reasons that the cases take as long as they do involve, for example, if there's been a trial, there has to be a trial transcript prepared, there has to be a clerk's record put together. All those things take time, and then the parties have to submit briefing, and all of that stuff takes time, and lawyers request continuances and extensions of time and all those kinds of things. But understand that once the case is ready for oral argument and the case is heard by the court, on our end, the way that our process works is we are actively managing that case among the five of us from the moment it gets heard until the time we get that final opinion. So you're not going to have long dragged out, you know, months waiting for opinions and that kind of thing. Now, it may be that that those opinions are going to get drafted and redrafted and revised and re-revised, and we may have multiple sit-down conferences with each other to hash out some of the details. And so there you'll find some delays. But I know in my own mind, I think of the Ohio principle, you know, that you learn back in business school, only handle it once. And so once that thing is in my hands from oral argument, I need to keep it in my active data bank memory, you know, and so that I've got those facts and those details readily accessible to me.
Sure. So Justice, with the way that the cases are assigned, you all come from diverse legal backgrounds. I mean, are you allowed to kind of have like a favorite topic on the court, or maybe a few topics where you're like, oh, I really am interested in this, and so as assignments go, I'm more than eager to take these on?
Well, nobody gets cases assigned like that, all right? Tradition is tradition. Those 15 tiles, that's how we take the case assignments, all right? So having said that, though, that's the beauty and the wisdom of our constitutional framers in having five people make decisions. Because we all come from different backgrounds, because we have different experiences and strengths, and we're called upon to look at those things. I mean, I remember a case where it was dealing with attorney's fee liens, and I'm like, okay, now this is something I can talk about. I mean, I got some personal thoughts and experiences in how this stuff ought to play out. And I think that's what our constitutional framers wanted.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a great observation. And I guess for folks listening, the other aspect of that with the diversity is the court, as it's currently composed, also has Idaho geographical diversity within it, because we've got justices from North Idaho and Central Idaho and Eastern Idaho. And I think that that's fairly impressive, too, is that not only the legal background, but kind of that geographical background and how the shape of the state sometimes shapes the law to some degree.
Well, I think anytime you've got people who have different perspectives, you know, when you get the collective thoughts, I think it can strengthen the product that you put out, for sure.
Brian, I have a question for you. As someone who has argued cases in front of the state Supreme Court, is there anything different as an attorney that you do in terms of preparation or what your mindset is in going into that particular courtroom versus going into other courts that serve on a more local level?
So I think that there are a couple of big differences, I think. And part of it is I kind of like to think of arguing in front of the Idaho Supreme Court as you're kind of arguing at the top of the law. And what I mean by the top of the law is you're arguing at a court that their decision is going to impact every part of the state. And so even though, you know, a lot of times we have cases that are on very specific fact patterns and scenarios, once you get to the Idaho Supreme Court, the decision in that case with regard to that fact pattern or scenario may very well impact the state of the law everywhere else within the state. And so I think that one of the things that I tend to think about when I'm preparing for an Idaho Supreme Court argument is, what are the other impacts of this case if I win or if I lose, and how is that going to affect all of these other scenarios that are likely to bubble up or foreseeable? And I think the other thing that is really different is when you're standing there in front of five different folks, it's really hard to guess what the thing is in their mind that they most want to hear about. And so, you know, you prepare. I mean, the one thing you can't overdo for an Idaho Supreme Court hearing is you can't over-prepare. And so, you know, we have, and you've sat through them, Scott, where we have moot courts, and then we have folks that come up with questions, and then we sit there and we try to, you know, to some degree guess which justice will ask which set of questions, and it's impossible to do, right? I can't tell you how many times we've kind of struck out on that and then shown up in front of the Supreme Court panel, and they ask a question, and you have to pause for a minute because you're like, well, that's a really good question. There's a reason why those folks are sitting in those chairs.
Justice, do you see maybe wider eyes from attorneys in front of you as a state Supreme Court justice, as maybe compared to those that justices sitting at lower benches on the court pipeline might see? Are there nerves sometimes that are obvious when attorneys come in front of you for the first time?
I think anytime you approach our courtroom, it can feel a little bit overwhelming. I'm sure I had those wide eyes myself from time to time. But one thing I didn't realize on the court is that we actually have a group of what I call the frequent flyers, and that's the deputy attorneys general and the state appellate public defenders. And those folks actually argue in front of us multiple times, sometimes multiple times a month, sometimes multiple times a day. And for them, it's all old hat.
Brian, do you keep a running total of how many times you have argued in front of the court?
I don't. And part of it is that I actually don't think about that as part. I don't think of it as a volume sort of endeavor. I think of it more as a quality endeavor, and, you know, how can you best present whatever the current issue is and get to the depth necessary. And so I really don't think that, you know, when you think about these sorts of things and you think about, you know, cases, you don't want to think about it in terms of quantity. You want to think about legal work in terms of quality, even though at times you can become overwhelmed by the quantity to a degree that you start to worry about your quality. At the end of the day, it's really not about case counts and numbers. It's about the quality of the effort and the research and the interpretation that you put into those legal cases.
But I assume since it is the state Supreme Court, the highest court in all of Idaho, it does feel a little bit different when you're prepping to argue there. Do you remember your first time? Did you have some extra nerves there that maybe you don't have in other courtrooms?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is there is never a time that, at least for me, when I walk into a courtroom where I'm not nervous. And I think that it's just, you know, you've prepared, you think that you're ready, but you never know exactly what's going to happen once kind of the lights go on and the courtroom proceedings start. So there's always a little bit of nervousness. And I've actually had some older, wiser attorneys counsel, you know, to the effect that, you know, the day to be worried is the day that you walk into a courtroom and you don't have that little bit of nervousness to you. And so I think that, you know, to me, that nervousness is what keeps you preparing and keeps ensuring that you put everything you have into it. And, you know, when you walk into the Idaho Supreme Court, it really feels a lot like, I'm going to use a baseball reference here, but it feels like you're walking into kind of the big leagues, if that makes sense, right? And as you go up the ladder of courtrooms, you know, it gets a little bit more special and majestic. And I can tell you, I've had the experience of being a second chair in a case in the United States Supreme Court. And that is a feeling that you kind of never prepare yourself for, like you can visualize it, but you never forget that feeling of sitting that closely to those justices. And the feeling is very similar within the Idaho Supreme Court.
Justice Brody, I'm crossing all the questions off my list. This is the last one I have for you, but Brian just brought up the U.S. Supreme Court there. Of course, an Idaho Supreme Court decision can be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. There have been cases that have been argued in your court. The court makes a decision. They're appealed to Washington, D.C., and the Supreme Court overturns them. What's, as a member of the state Supreme Court, what's that feeling like when you hear that your decision has been overturned by the Supreme Court in the entire nation?
Well, let me back up just one step there. Not every case can be appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States, all right? The Idaho Supreme Court is the final decision makers on issues of Idaho law. And we are a completely independent body and capable of making our own decisions. The issue, and sometimes people ask me, you know, are they your boss? No, not at all. What it is that issues of federal law and issues of the U.S. Constitution can be appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. Those are the decisions that we make that are subject to their jurisdiction and their review. And frankly, you know, the last decision we had that was actually reversed by the Supreme Court of the United States, it split their court 5-4. So it's one of those things that for us, you know, it's a matter that people can disagree about. They do disagree about. And at the end of the day, when it comes to the U.S. Constitution, it's their view that prevails. So it's not personal. And we just keep moving on and doing our job.
Okay. Brian, any further questions for Justice Brody before we wrap up here on the podcast?
So I do. And I think that, you know, Justice Brody, we talked a little bit about how you are a trailblazer as far as being a member of a very small group of women that have ascended to the Idaho Supreme Court. There's only been three of you, but you are a first as well within that group because you are the first of the women on the Supreme Court to run for the position. And I think that, you know, to me, one of the big question marks for folks that are interested in that position is what it takes to simply decide to run for it. And I wonder if you could talk about that for a minute.
Well, you know, I certainly don't think of myself as any kind of trailblazer. And I'll tell you, I had so much help along the way. But anyone who's considering a run for office, whether it be my office or something else, I'll tell you, the first thing you got to do is just dive in. There's never enough items on the resume, right? People say, well, I need to check this box or check that box in order to run for office. And there's never enough. And so at some point in time, you've just got to do it. And what I tell young people every time I get a chance to talk to them about pursuing dreams and things like that is you got to tell people what's in your heart, what you want. And it is amazing to me how many people are willing to help whenever they see folks really going after a dream, really wanting to do something good. They're willing to help in ways that you just would not imagine.
And I think that the way that you said that and, you know, talking from your heart is so important. And one of the things that I will tell you before this conversation I did not know about, but in researching to prepare for it, I have learned that one of the things near and dear to your heart is the Ford Pinto. Can you talk about that?
Well, I may be one of the only human beings in the history of the world to have owned not just one, but two Ford Pintos. My dad's philosophy in life was that if we all drove those, the world would be a little humbler place.
I think that's fantastic. I love that sentiment. And I actually feel like a lot of your success maybe comes from that natural affinity that you have for Ford Pintos.
Well, I'll tell you, it's the affinity I have for my father.
Sure.
Justice, what colors were they? I'm curious. I think the only two Pintos I remember people in my hometown driving were orange and a sort of like lima bean green.
Okay. So mine were red and green. Christmas tree. Yeah, right? So I had the Christmas tree Pintos. And one last thing about those Pintos. The red one, it was so funny. I always wanted to ask Click and Clack on the radio what the deal was. But if I pulled the key out, it kept running. So I had to leave the key in the ignition all the time. But nobody ever wanted it, so it was no problem.
I wish you would have called in. That seems like the perfect, with the car and the quirkiness of the issue, that seems like the perfect car talk call.
Absolutely. I love those guys.
I really enjoyed this conversation. I knew going into this that you were a busy person when you detailed the court's caseload and the process for working through each case. I became even more aware of just how busy you and all of the justices on the court are. So I really appreciate you finding some time to join us here on Counsel for the State. Is there anything that we have not given you the opportunity to talk about that you would like to mention before we wind things down?
The only thing I would tell people out there is to check out what the courts do. Get online. You can easily find a link to watch what goes on in our courtroom. You can watch what goes on in courtrooms across our state. You can go over to your local courts. Well, maybe the pandemic kind of messes things up a little bit or frustrates the process, but we are open. And I'll tell you what, don't wait for someone to tell you what happened. Go see what happens in our courts. I think you'll be very impressed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Counsel for the State. We do appreciate
it. Take good care.
Brian, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
A reminder that each episode of Counsel for the State is available through iTunes and Spotify. If you know someone who would like to listen in and they are not a podcast subscriber, they can also listen in by going to the Attorney General's website. That is ag.idaho.gov. Once you're there, just look for the word podcast on the big blue button on the AG's homepage, and you'll be able to find this and past episodes of Counsel for the State. Thanks again for being with us.